Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood, right here on The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
One thing we in the movie business that have the job of being a producer fight against is the stereotype of the producer itself. Most people in media and in movies and television portray producers as cigar-chomping assholes that drive around in convertible Mercedes and yell on the phone all day and just do nothing but bully people and make people feel bad or worse. Right now in Hollywood, there's a lot of horrible stuff that is coming out, and a lot of people are suffering the consequences for their insane actions. I can say that my generation of friends and guys that do what I do are the polar opposite of that stereotype. And in fact, in some cases, not only are they my really, really good friends, but they're actually family. This next guest is no exception. He is actually part of my family by extension. We'll talk about that at the beginning of the interview, but then quickly get into how he has been able to work outside of the system and create amazingly moving and powerful motion pictures that will definitely stand the test of time and I'm sure will be on people's top 10 lists for all eternity. His name is Basil Iwanek. He is a great, great producer, and he is my next guest. Enjoy. All right, I'm here with Basil Iwanek. Hi, Basil.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, man. You know what? A lot of people say that Hollywood is a small town.
Yes. I know where this is going.
We're all just big buddies. But, you know, a lot of people may not know that you married my ex-wife.
Yep.
You are my son's stepfather. Both of our we look like we could be brothers.
Yes.
We both have gray hair now, although you less than me. And both of our companies are named after songs that have the word road in it.
Yeah.
So it's fucking crazy. And we've been friends for probably 25 years. So this is a good one for
me.
And
the funny thing is my two youngest kids that I had with Natalie, I asked him one time, I'm like, so what is Todd's relationship to you? He goes, he's our stepdad. I'm like, well, kind of. He's like my brother-in-law.
The best text I ever got, and I laugh about still to this day, was when you texted me that your youngest son and you got in an argument. He goes, well, fine, I'll just go live with my stepdad. And
you're
like,
he did.
Who? I'll just go live with Todd. I don't care. It's not quite the way it works, but yes, we have a lot in common, including the fact that my son doesn't want to go to either of our colleges. So
no. Pretty much, and that was within 5 minutes of heading onto the Villanova campus.
Yeah, right. Well, and he didn't even visit the Occidental campus, so it's fine. So, dude, you have had such an amazing career, especially of late. Congratulations on Sicario 2 coming out and doing so well. And Wind River was just an amazing, amazing, amazing movie. And you have literally been nominated for every f***ing award imaginable. So tell me.
I haven't won one.
That's all right. Yeah. Hey, it's all just being invited to the dance,
that's
brother.
True.
So. You grew up in New Jersey.
Yep.
Why do so many film people and artists grow up in New Jersey? What is it about New Jersey? What the hell are you guys doing over there that there's so many people? Just on my podcast, like from New Jersey, Dan Fogelman, from New Jersey. You're from New Jersey. It's like so many people. And what is it? Is it just that you guys live in the shadow of New York? So you're like, F*** it, watch how successful I'm going to be. It seems so many people come from New Jersey that are creative.
Yeah, because New Jersey's not known for its arts and culture. You know, I think we had just a normal childhood. I think you hit it on the head. I think there is and I didn't realize this until I got older. Mm-hmm. There's something about being from Jersey where you have a chip on your shoulder. Now, it doesn't manifest itself with anger. Like, you're not pissed off at people.
Well, some.
Some, that's true. But you definitely have this, you know, listen, for the longest time until The Sopranos, there was a long time where New Jersey was like one of the, you know, tied with West Virginia as the state that people would make fun of the most.
Right.
And then then Bruce Springsteen and Sopranos gave a bit of an edge. But when you're growing up, you know, you are in the shadow of New York, in the shadow of Philly. You know, you are, you know, I'm a New York Jets fan. Everyone says, oh, New York Jets, but they play in New Jersey. But everyone forgets about that.
Right.
And so
wife's from Jersey.
Yeah.
And she's an Eagles fan because she's from South Jersey.
Well, that's the other thing, too. South
you
Jersey
can't even
is,
really have your own f***ing team. You
I
have
know.
To, like, glom onto the teams around you.
Completely. And I think you do get a little bit of a chip on your shoulder. And also, I think, I hate to say it, a lot of people were ready to leave Jersey when they graduated college. Now, the irony is I want to go back all the time. Right. But at the time, in my 20s, I was ready to get out.
But you're also growing up with real people.
Yes.
So you're seeing real life.
Yes.
You're seeing real world experiences.
Oh, no question.
You're not in this crazy town of Hollywood where everything is, you know, 95% bullshit.
Yep.
You're growing up with real people. You're going to, you know, restaurants and places where there are real people. Your friends are real friends. So you're having real human experiences. And I think it's so important that, you know, a lot of people, when they ask me, you know, how do I become a producer? It's like they want to get to L.A. as quickly as possible. All they've done is made movies their whole life on their iPhones.
Yeah.
or, you know, depending how old you are, you know, video cameras. And you got to live your fucking life.
Yeah.
Like, you got to have like life experience to understand what romance is. You see movies sometimes where it just seems so fake, and you realize that's because they grew up on movies.
Yeah.
So their take of real life is from a movie that they saw, and they're parodying back that movie. They didn't have a real romance. They didn't have real heartbreak. They didn't have real life growing up. And that's also why I think New Jersey probably gives so many creative people, is it's just you're living in such a melting pot of all kinds of different cool cultures.
Yeah, I mean, it is the most – I mean, it's a little trivia question. It is, per density, the most populated state in the United States. And you do have people who have grown up there. You have people who live in New York, or excuse me, work in New York, and they commute from the city. You have every – and I also grew up on the Jersey Shore. So I had people who came there just for the summer. You have a melting pot of everybody, and there's no pretense.
Right.
And listen, as you know, being a fellow dad, it's the one concern about raising kids in L.A. Uh-huh. You know, you just want to make sure they have that edge, you know, that desire to win, whatever that chip on the shoulder, you want them to still have it, because I wanted to win desperately when I was growing up. And you just hope to God that your kids do too.
And not living in a homogeneous environment.
Completely.
Certainly Jersey wasn't. I grew up in San Fernando, certainly wasn't. Because it definitely, although I will say, a lot of, you know, legacies, a lot of kids that are big time producers and actors and writers, their parents were the same, or an agent, you know, and they became a producer or a manager. So I think it is really, you're right. You just got to instill in your kids that fire and that hunger and the will to want to do something great, because it's hard. This is hard work.
Would you want Jake to be a producer?
If he wanted to be, I think between you and I, in his life, he has no pretense of or romanticism of what this f-ing job is. So I don't think he thinks that my son Jacob is 17 and he's going to college, and he's looking at colleges like UT in Michigan. I think he understands that if you have a myopic view of like, I'm just going to go into the movie business, you're either going to get your heart broken or you're going to, you know, make it, right?
Yeah.
So I think knowing the chance of that is kind of like becoming a professional athlete. Like, you have to just dedicate yourself to it at some point. I think he has no illusions. Therefore, I would be fine with it. I would not be fine with it if he's like, well, my dad and stepdad are both producers. They'll f-ing get me a job. I'll be an intern, and then I'll just – that guy's going to get killed, and that's not who he is. So I'm fine. I mean, I hope he – and so far he has. Like, he has never expressed – he's been on so many sets, and now he's like doesn't even want to come to the sets.
No.
I think that at this point he's seeing the world a little bigger than just his zip code.
Well, I mean, the one thing that I have to say, that people that Jake and even my two younger sons, Charlie or Dylan or Molly, have, when I was growing up in New Jersey, I dreamed about the film business.
Right.
You know what I mean? I dreamed about movies. It was so romantic to me. Mm-hmm. It was so alien to me. It was the equivalent of dreaming to be a professional athlete.
Yeah.
And I had the same dreams, and I thought the dream of, like, no chance. And I dreamed of Southern California. It looked amazing.
Right.
You know, and it looked like a great place to live. Both of those dreams slightly tempered over the years.
No, sure.
But I think that was also drove me, which is, you know, I had this vision of what my life would look like, and I'm like, I'm going to go do it.
When did that start? How early did you say, I want to be in the movie business? And could you define it? Because, by the way, your career, you went to Villanova.
Yep.
You were a trainee at UTA.
Yep.
Then you went to a smaller company and developed movies. Then you went to Warner Brothers. You were the youngest vice president, which I didn't know, by the way. Congratulations.
At the time, yeah.
Okay. Has there someone who eclipsed you?
Probably. And I just use that a lot just to, you know, I was single at the time. You needed some way in. Yeah, we all know that.
So. Yeah, right. And then, you became a producer. So it wasn't like you went, or maybe you did, I want to be a producer, because you took a circuitous route to get there.
Yeah, I mean, listen, when I went to Villanova, I thought I was going to do what everybody else does on the East Coast, which is you're going to work in finance, become a lawyer or a doctor. Those were the only choices. And they really, and here's the irony. The irony is I was, which I don't know if you know this, I was destined, really since I've been 10 years old, to go to West Point. My uncle went to West Point.
I can see that.
I loved the military. I was an Army guy. We went to football games there all the time. And I got in. I got in. I passed the physical. I passed the academic part. I got Bill Bradley to write me a letter of recommendation. I failed the medical because of my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
The irony is that if I applied now, I would get in because now they've loosened up the restrictions.
Mm.
And so I thought I was going to West Point. I went to Villanova. In some ways, it was a really easy It was a very easy application. I filled it out in homeroom. And it was, I think, one of the only two. I mean, I also applied like Princeton. My head was up my
Yeah, because how did those things jive of wanting to be moved to Southern California and being in the movie business at 10 years old?
I never wanted to. See, that's the thing. I dreamed about it.
I see.
I dreamed about it like you dreamed of being an astronaut mm-hmm. or a professional football player.
Right.
I just thought, but I never thought it was
achievable. Your destiny was you were going to be, in the military for, long as it took till you got a CEO job. Somewhere.
Exactly. Or right. I knew, I didn't really know what I was going to do, mm-hmm. I was so defined, I'm very close to my family and they were like, this is what you're going to do. I'm like, okay, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to do something different and special. It was disappointing not getting into West Point, go to Villanova, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to law school. So I was a double major in philosophy and political science. Philosophy because at the time it was the highest LSATs. It was the major that had the highest LSAT scores, and right. I wanted to go to a good law school. And my family, unbeknownst to me, I thought my family was disappointed. I went to Villanova. In retrospect, I realized I didn't care. In fact, right. I think my mom was relieved. I think
that you didn't go to West Point.
I didn't go to West Point.
Oh, yeah. Cause...
And I was relieved. And I look back, I'm like, oh, my God.
Imagine sending your son now, especially. Well, actually, back then, too, is scary. I mean, because there's no guarantees that you're going to just be on a track that you're going to, get out and do a startup. You could have gone to war.
100%. In fact, there were football players that we used to follow a lot when I was younger going to West Point games that went to Iraq. One of them, horrible. This guy, Nate Sassaman, was this incredible quarterback, went to Iraq. Did something terrible to, and I don't think he meant to, but they did something terrible to some Iraqi prisoners. The Iraqi prisoners were killed, and Nate Sassaman lost his entire. See these things,
yeah.
and by now, for the grace of God, goes I.
Right.
But when I was at Nova, film school was a big thing back then. It was USC, NYU. It was John Singleton.
Yep.
All that stuff.
And Well, I mean, Spielberg,
completely.
Phil Juano.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All this stuff. Yep. And that was not, when I was in high school, film school was, I didn't even know what film school was.
Right.
And it became, and I used to read Premier Magazine. You remember Premier Magazine?
Sure.
And I remember I came home from Christmas, or it was some holiday, like my sophomore year in college. And just to kind of mess with my family, I'm like, I don't want to go to law school. I want to go to film school. Just to annoy them and provoke them.
Just to see the reaction, right.
And they looked at me and they're like, God, that's a really good idea.
Holy shit.
And I'm like, are you kidding me? And from that moment on, all of a sudden it became more realistic.
Right.
And I applied. I got into USC film school, the graduate screenwriting program. And when I graduated college, I went out there. And I lasted a semester because I was done with school.
Right.
And everyone I met at SC was like, why are you – I interned the summer before, and everyone was like, why are you going to graduate school for screenwriting?
Right.
If you want to write, go write.
Yeah,
do whatever you want. And
now, did you in your undergrad – were you a reader? Were you a reader growing up?
I'm a reading nerd.
Right. Okay, so you've always read even through all school and college
for fun, obsessive
reading.
It's so much so that my mom – there was this thing called the freshman directory into Villanova where it was a picture of every freshman coming in and what their passion was. And it was, by the way, where every upperclassman saw the cute freshman
girls.
And my mom, I must have been, I don't know where I was, but it came in and she was like, oh, I better answer this for him. And so she gave me my picture and she said, my greatest passion is reading. When everybody else had something cool like surfing or something like rugged, right. Mine was reading. And yeah, I was a huge reader growing up. But you're right. That's where it starts. It's
right.
Stories. I mean, and
so were you always influenced by the stories that you're telling now? Because you definitely have a type of movie that you are known for, that you clearly gravitate towards. Does that come from reading for fun novels and maybe even philosophy in undergrad?
Yeah. I mean, there's a correlation between some of the earlier films I did when I was an executive that were really bad and really unwatchable. I did because I felt like that's what the audience wanted.
Mm-hmm.
versus as I've gotten more confident as a storyteller and as a producer, realizing, okay, I'm going to try to tell stories that I like and mm-hmm. that I would want to see, and pray to God that someone else agrees with me.
Would Training Day be one of those movies?
Training Day would, yeah. I've always been obsessed mm-hmm. with law enforcement, police officers, and the idea of...
That's another thing from Jersey, by the way. You got right from Jersey.
No, but I just think I've always had... You know, I think because I worked in bars in the Jersey Shore growing up, mm-hmm. and as bouncers and barbacks, mm-hmm. and we would be... There'd be a bunch of guys in the corner who would look like all mobbed up and big and righted mm-hmm. and really nasty looking guys, and they weren't mob guys. They were cops off duty, and right. I realized that they were as flawed and as interesting as what any other character was. So even from youth, I was just interested to know that you had a break. And also, I think it's coming outside, living, growing up outside of New York, where there were so many police corruption scandals in the 70s and 80s, that, you know, there were cops who did wrong to try to do right.
Mm-hmm.
And most people, in some ways, would agree with that. But then there's always a way that there's always a point where they drift into too much wrong.
Right.
And I just love that stuff. And that's what Training Day.
Well, the town, Sicario, yeah. I mean, they're not cops, but the same idea is that the town, Sicario.
Wind River.
Yeah, Wind River. Cops that are complicated.
Yeah, I, you know, it's become a running joke now with my company that we have so many of these.
Right.
But it's just something that I really respond to emotionally and in terms of just like thematically.
Mm-hmm.
And I also find that a lot of actors all want to play cops and gangsters.
Right. Well, that's for sure. You have made a lot of movies that are really hard to get made.
Yes.
So how and obviously, just given what you just said, there are movies that you're attracted to and you want to see, and by getting them made, you find out there actually is an audience for them. But it was – you never went like just – you know, you were an executive at Warner Brothers, and that's where you made Training Day, and then you were a producer right away, and you made Clash of the Titans and We Are Marshall, more traditional studio fare at that time. But then you made this big pivot, you know, and The Town, even though it was a studio movie between The Town and John Wick and Wind River and Sicario and these movies that Netflix and television has really taken over. I mean, mm-hmm. Sicario obviously could have been a TV series in a second. So could have Wind River, by the way. And then Taylor went off to make basically similar thing with Yellowstone.
Yeah.
So how are you getting it made? What are you doing different than, like, you know, the traditional studio producer? Tell me how your company's financing. And then how – also walk me through how you got to that place.
Well, I think it's funny because people ask me advice – young producers about Hollywood, and I always say to them, like, don't listen to anyone. Like, don't even read the trades, because if you read the trades, it sounds like the world's falling apart.
That's exactly why I did this podcast.
And right now, I think in my entire career, there has never been a better time to be a content provider.
Mm-hmm.
That if you have a good story or a good script, somebody out there is going to want to tell your story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now, you know, it's films, but, you know, clearly with Amazon, Netflix, and all the other places. But also, concurrently, the world is huge. And these foreign distributors, you know, the rest of the world are desperate for material as well. And so, for me, I think there's one or two things. You know, we did well financially on the Clash of Titans movies and on John Wick, which allowed me to make movies where I wasn't focused on what I'd get paid.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment you're not focused on what you're going to make on a movie, options start appearing all over the place, and where you want to be able to bet on the upside if it does well. Because a lot of these movies, I understand, these are tough movies to pull off, and so you have to do it for a budget. And you have to just – and to do it for a budget, everyone's going to have to cut. And so that allows you just options. You know, that allows you being able – you know, a couple of movies we had in Toronto, like this Hotel Mumbai, it's about the terrorist attack in Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai. Like, that's a tough subject.
Private war is a tough subject.
Private war, tough
and
subject.
Current war, you have a lot of war movies.
Yeah,
and neither of them really war.
I know.
And a current war. So these movies that you're making, again, so Mumbai and current war and private war and these movies and Wind River, certainly, they're tough. They're tough to get made.
Yeah, they are.
So, and it's never been a better time to be a content provider. So how is your company structured? Walk me through. You did We Are Marshall. You obviously were attached to A Star Is Born. Congratulations. It's finally getting made. And that movie came together and fell apart a million times. And if you were just a guy that was just on A Star Is Born, which seems like a great bet because you had Beyonce at one point, you would be broke. And you'd be brought back in Jersey being a barback till that movie came out and maybe you'd come back out. But you have so many things going on. You have like 7 movies that are yet to come out. And you were a studio guy. You grew up in the studio system.
Yep.
You were making those big studios movies. When did you pivot to your current financing situation, and how is that structured?
It was the town, because the Titans movies. Well, that was the at the time. Clash of Titans was really, really a really hard process, really difficult, and it was, and it was fun at times, but it felt. You know, you're almost, you're not even like a producer at a certain point. You're just, you're like a, I don't know what you are.
You're an executive on the movie.
You're executive on the movie.
And on those big movies, especially when it's IP that the studio controls and it's come from the studio and there's nobody, it's like all the Disney movies. There's nobody bigger than the Disney brand.
Nope.
As James Gunn so eloquently showed the world that if you make one mistake and you're potentially going to tinge that Disney brand, you're dead. You're gone.
Oh, especially the producer, because there's 50 people behind me that would come up for half the price and go, thank you.
Yeah, so Clash of the Titans is a big studio movie, and you were a studio guy at that studio, and they wanted you to do the same job, right? I'm sure. Like, call us, make sure that everything's going good, make sure he doesn't go off the rails. It's not like what you're doing now, where you are there, sleeves rolled up,
completely.
You know, making shit happen.
And the town... We wrapped Clash of Titans, and like 2 weeks later, I was in Boston for the town. And the thing about the town was, it was so much fun. The people on the movie, the actors on the movie, every day was a joy. Mm-hmm. And it was, instead of shooting like 4 setups a day sometimes, we would set, you know, like in Clash of Titans, all these visual effects and, you know, silver balls and all that. Mm-hmm. It was, we were actually filming full scenes and sequences. And Ben was... awesome. And he wanted to be produced because he was also the first time he was acting and directing. And so you just felt good about yourself every day.
Yeah.
And you had a laugh every day. And then the irony of it, even though we got paid very little money up front, the movie did well financially. And I got paid more money ultimately on the town than I did on Clash of Titans. And so I realized at that point a couple things. One, I wanted to build a company. You know, it was really important to me. I didn't just want to be a producer and produce films. I wanted to build a company that produced films, but I wanted to build a company. I knew that was impossible to do at a studio.
Yeah.
Because, as you painfully know from back in the day, and any studio producer knows, you're beholden to the whims of the studio, the personalities of the studio, what actor or actress or writer or director that they like this week could change the next week and they could change back. And there are slots they could make and there are certain movies they want from you and that's it. And I'm like, how do I project ahead 10 years? Like, what is my... life going to look like? I'll have no ownership. Yeah, every once in a while, I'll be able to do a couple of smaller independent movies. Like I did Brooklyn's Finest when I was at Warner's, but you know, there was an overhead reimbursement, all that stuff. And I'm like, God, I want to, I was itching to do this. Like I want to go and be an independent producer. And everyone I spoke to were like, you're nuts. Like all the independent producers want to go and be at a studio. Mm-hmm. But I felt like a well-paid government employee. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like middle management, even though I was a producer. And don't get me wrong, I love the Warner Brothers people. Like, I love them. They're to me, traditionally, the best studio in the world. Mm-hmm. I so admire their movies. But I needed to do something different. And it was getting boring, for lack of a term. I wanted to be on my own. I also, weirdly enough, I wanted to be closer to home, my office. I was tired of going into the valley. And I wanted to see if I could bet on myself and see what it worked. So I went to CAA. I went to Micah Green, who's no longer there. And I said, Micah, I know you're going to laugh, but I want to leave and I want to be an independent producer. I want to have development money. I want to have ownership in my movies and I want to have creative ownership in my movies. And Micah's like, done. He's like, your movies have done really well internationally. All those distributors want the type of movies you do.
Because you also had, at that time, you had Expendables, too.
Yeah.
So you had Clash of the Titan, Expendables, and Town, like boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, I had a good...
That's
like
2010, 2011.
Yeah, I had a good momentum going in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I had very little to do with Expendables 2 and 3. I mean...
It doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. And the distributors didn't care. And so what I did was I had a couple of... but I also wanted to own 100% of my company. Mm-hmm. And so I had a music company invest into my... into my production company for development. And I had a couple of distributors who would give me money for development and overhead in exchange for the rights of my films in their territories.
So out of the gate, for an exchange for development money, which is what you need, because you're not doing high concept stuff. You need to go option books. You need to...
The premise I had was there are a million distributors now in Hollywood. It's even more now. This was 6 years ago. And a lot of people were like, oh, we want mid-sized movies and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, but nobody is a content company. Mm-hmm. Everybody has the financing structure and the distribution structure, but who controls the content? And I've learned from my days at Warner's, the most important element, invaluable currency in all of Hollywood is that unencumbered script. you have that script and you control it and it's good and people want it. All of a sudden, the deals become great. All of a sudden, the movies become big. And so I work backwards. I'm like, everyone was afraid of development. It's amazing. You go to people and they're like, oh, 50 grand, I can't do that. We spent all our investment in development, all of it. And over time, even now, we have about 65, 70 projects that we either hold 100% own or at least 50% own. And now we're able to create our own.
You're talking about the scripts at this point.
The scripts at this point. And so, and then I have to say, as it is in all cases, I got lucky. The first movie was John Wick. Second movie was Sicario. So I look like a genius. I mean, I've made movies that weren't as good as those movies many times.
And by attrition, there's a lot of movies that they're not letting you make. So
completely.
Weirdly, by getting lucky was a lot of failure, which we talk about on this podcast too, which is
endless failure.
You see, you seem like a genius because your two came out back to back. But what people probably don't know is there's 30 that you were pushing just as hard that for some reason or another did not get made.
Well, also, I mean, I've told this story many times because I'm in awe of it. On John Wick, we financed it ourselves. We found the financing. We had Lionsgate sell the international. So the domestic was open. And
well, at the time also, to be fair, it was a very good script. It was a hinky premise because whenever anybody that wanted to just put it into a tiny little box would pitch it, they'd say, an ex-hitman, his dog is killed, and he goes on a rampage.
Even now you laugh.
Sounds crazy. You had Keanu Reeves, who was great in The Matrix, but was cold, and you had his stunt guys that were going to direct it. So this is not an easy movie for you to put together. You can't just minimize the fact of, oh, we found financing. That's an incredible feat given all of what I just pitched.
Patrick Waxberger, who sold it for us, did an incredible job. And we thought, okay, we watched the dailies and the dailies were great. And like, okay, I'm going to finish this movie, deliver it. And then I'm going to show it to the studios and it's going to be a bidding war. Todd, the same exact movie that came out, I showed to every studio in town. Everyone passed.
Yeah.
Lionsgate bought it for zero. And they gave us a big chunk of the ownership.
Yeah. Well, the same thing with Saw. They did the same thing with Saw.
And it's like,
because they knew that Lionsgate knew how to do that because of Saw and Tyler Perry. They knew that, look, we'll bet on you. We're going to put the resources behind it. We believe this is a good thing outside of the studio system, which is where your bread and butter is.
Yeah.
And obviously the bet paid off.
Well, the funny thing is I have people would call me 6 or 7 months after John Wick came out and go, we want our version of John Wick.
Right.
I'm like, you could have had it for nothing.
Right.
If you gave us $1 million, I would have been elated.
Yeah.
We looked into the abyss. I actually thought, okay, John Wick's going to be terrible. It's going to be a disaster. And at least Sicario's there. I swear to you, it was under the radar.
John Wick?
John Wick.
Oh, of course.
Chad, one of our directors, went down, the moment we wrapped, down to South Africa to do second unit. Keanu was like, I'm going to do television. We all went to our sides going, okay, this was a miss. And so that's the great thing about the film business.
But what? Go back. First of all, how do you get the script? A. B. Was Keanu attached when it came in?
No.
And C. Why do you bet on these two guys that now are, you know, done all three John Wicks for you, you know, and David's gone off to do, Deadpool 2, and now he's doing the spinoff from Fast and the Furious. He's massive now. But what made you bet on these two guys that were just Keanu? One was literally a stunt double. The other were, and then they would coordinate together.
Yeah.
What made you think these guys are going to do this gun-fu thing better than anybody who's ever done it since, Face Off?
Well, I think we met with a lot of directors, and at the time it was, you know, a programmer. And so what you get is you get the kind of the programmer list. You know, someone who did one or two okay movies and they're pretty good and you're like, all right, and they come in. And I just wanted something different and fresh. I mean, it was my first independent film, and as in the independent Thunder Road, I'm like, you gotta, you know, fortune favors the bold. You got to do something brave. I learned that from Lorenzo, who was my mentor at Warner's, where when everyone expected people to go right, he would go left in certain choices. And then Robinoff, who was the chairman and the president after Lorenzo, was exactly the same way. And that's how I was just trained. And they came in and they said, listen, we want to come in they were always going to do second unit on John Wick.
Well, sorry to interrupt. Were you around when Robinoff greenlit The Matrix?
Lorenzo greenlit The Matrix. Robinoff was the executive on it. Yeah.
Because it was his clients that brought it to them. It was Wachowski's Jeff used to represent, correct?
Yeah. Jeff gave it to Lorenzo.
Right.
And then Lorenzo became a president of production, brought Jeff over as a senior VP, and Jeff got the movie made.
Did you see that happen?
Oh, yeah.
Was that instrumental in getting, you know, did you ever draw on those experiences?
Oh, my God.
John Wick. Okay, because that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. And well, that's the irony. The irony is Chad really bonded with Keanu over in The Matrix.
Yeah, well, I knew that. That's why I was wondering if that had colored your view as this team kind of walked in. And did Chad, when Chad and David came in, did they say, we can get Keanu? Or did somebody just Keanu go,
Keanu was, I have
an idea.
Here's what happened. Keanu was attached. And we were going through directors. And it was about a year of script process. Going through directors, these guys came in and gave us, to this day, one of the two or three best director presentations that I've ever seen.
So they did a rip reel and they did a lookbook? What did
they do?
They
did a rip reel, lookbook, and they set up some boxes in their facility down in Manhattan. Well, it's in by the airport, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they did all that gung-fu stuff that you see in the movie, they showed what it looked like.
Oh, that's
and it was amazing.
Well, listen, that is a huge, huge thing to stop and talk about for 1 second, because John M. Chu was in here the other day, and he said, you know, because you look at that guy's career and you go, my God, he came out, he did a short, the next he was attached to Bye Bye Birdie, the next thing he's doing Step Up, and now he's doing, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, and now he's doing Into the Heights. And you're like, simple.
Yeah.
He said he came in and fought for that job hard, did a rip reel, did a lookbook, and he said, that's one of 90.
Oh, yeah.
That I have sitting on my shelf. The other 81, I didn't get the fucking job. And so it's important as people are kind of coming up through the ranks that you don't just walk in and go, hey, I'm going to be a director and I'd like to direct your movie. You got to fight for it and show. And the fact that they set up boxes and showed you a whole sequence, that's beyond what probably normal people would do, but what you need to do to get the job.
Yeah. And also, I think the biggest issue for a first-time director is couldn't they get cast. And we had Keanu. And their presentation blew me away. And I was trying to think to myself, how do I get Keanu to say yes?
But he must have known Chad because he was his...
They love each other. Yeah. They're all really close friends.
Right, which, by the way, can be a hindrance,
totally.
Too. Because he's going to see him as, my stunt double is going to direct me? I don't think that's going
to
work.
So I thought to myself, is that going to offend him? He calls me, and he's so polite. There is nothing like him. The nicest man on the planet. He's so polite and so respectful of everybody's jobs. And he says, hey, I don't want to get too far into this, but I heard you met Chad and Dave, and I met him too, and I would, if you were cool with it, I would go with
holy
them. Yeah, and I'm like, great idea, Keanu, done.
But if you insist, Keanu.
But I remember when I realized that we were, you know, that it was a Dark Horse candidate, it was about like 3 months after we hired him, Ed Pressman calls me. And about something else.
Who produced The Crow.
Yes.
So it's like, that's a good call to get.
Yes. And by the way, you know, Chad was Brandon Lee's stunt double on The Crow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's all kismet. So Ed calls me and said, hey, I heard you hired Chad and Dave. We were talking to them about a movie as well, and then you stole it from us. Oh. I'm like, oh, wow. I'm like, what movie was it? Oh, it was like Midnight Run with Jean-Claude Van Damme and Psy.
Oh, my God.
You know,
gosh.
From Gangnam Style.
Yes. Oh,
and I'm
God.
Like, hold on. That's who I was in competition with?
Oh, my
like,
God.
What have I done?
They were doing those two presentations. Holy
exactly.
Shit.
Because I thought, you know, and I remember thinking to myself, just forget about this conversation and then later. So, yeah, now, but I mean, that's been
well, that's the thing about movies, too. Bad Boys was Dana Carvey and John Lovitz, and Bay was attached, and it was at Hollywood Pictures.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and they put it in turnaround and went to Sony, and Jerry was like, we're not doing it with
oh my God.
Those two guys. No offense to those two guys, and got two up-and-comers, Martin Lawrence and Will Smith. So it's the same thing. Had those guys done that, it would have looked amazing. By the way, you imagine Michael Bay directing John Lovitz and Dana Carvey. That movie would have been insane.
Yeah.
Because the movie would have looked incredible with these two guys in the middle
I know.
Of it.
They would have looked sexy.
I want to see that f***ing movie, by the way. But the same thing. If these guys would have directed Jean-Claude Van Damme and Psy, it would have been like an insane, cool like thing you get stoned and watch on a weekend in a college dorm, not John Wick.
But that's the thing. And this is not by design, but by accident, we've become... We've hired a lot of first-time directors in the last 4 years. And again, not by design. And it's been fun. You know, whether it's, Taylor Sheridan or Chad and Dave, the guy from, Matt Heineman on A Private War. Mm-hmm. I mean, we weren't that involved in A Star Is Born, but even Bradley Cooper. There's something, I think that energy of a first-time or second-time director where he or she really wants to win and they're really to work hard, they're not going to stand on ceremony. I'd rather have that than someone that comes in and goes, this is how it's done. And, you know, listen, there's always the mix of the two, of course.
Right.
But I love the energy of, you know, you're talking about John Chu. I'm sure that first movie, he would outworked everybody.
Oh, yeah. He still does.
Yeah.
Well, also, you can do that because you're a great producer.
Thank
and you're
you.
There every day and you're on the set and you know how to make these movies.
Yeah.
And so why Ben leaned on you... on the town is he's acting and directing, and he's like myopically looking at every little moment. And what, you know, as an actor, you're going, yeah. my face looks fat there or whatever. Yeah. So you have to be able to look over your right shoulder and say, do we got this? Because it's hard to do both those things because you can only be on one side of the monitor.
I don't understand how they can. I mean, that's incredible to me. How are you present where you're not looking at everyone around you? Yeah, it's incredible. I think their compartmentalization is just I can't do it.
Right. Are you looking for a new car? Do you know how to navigate what you're looking for? MSRP, invoice, list price, dealer price. It's enough to confuse anybody. You just want a price that means something. Introducing True Price from True Car. They compete for your business by showing you what other people pay for the car that you're after. Now you'll know exactly what you'll pay for the car you want, including fees and accessories, all from the comfort of home. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit True Car to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states.
This week, it's all about survival, and Rob's sister Nino is here to help. Check out Rob Has a Podcast as he kicks off a new season of Survivor.
And I guess you can go from you were almost a David, but you're back to a dud. But you cannot go from a Goliath to a David. Impossible!
You don't want to miss this. Check out Rob Has a Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is the Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
So you get this development money from these sources, and you get John Wick and you get Sicario out of the gate, and you're optioning books and you're getting writers to write, and it's just you guys with nobody else involved getting the best script you possibly can and then owning it. Then what? Now, how are you going to get your movies financed? Where do you see the business heading in terms of what you're doing and in terms of all this kind of untraditional finance that's flooding into the marketplace in different ways?
I think you have to remember that Netflix may be great for the American audience or Amazon, but for 85% or 80% of the rest of the world, they're seeing movies on film. Mm-hmm. And so what we do is, our first thing we do is we figure out what the international value of the movie is. And that's usually by going to a sales company and getting an analysis of, like, here's what, you know, you add up, you know, here's the value in the UK and you know, Scandinavia and China and Brazil and, East, you know, all there's 92 territories.
And is most of this based on stars, movie stars? Because your movies
used
are
to
not
be.
Well, look, you're not Wind River and Sicario and The Town and even John Wick to an extent, although there's a lot of action in John Wick, they're set in Alaska. They're set, set in like domestic, feels very domestic. How are you getting any numbers that are good enough that you can get your movies made?
I think the much more nowadays, the buyers are a lot smarter than they were 6-7 years ago. Mm-hmm. It is about the script and it's about the filmmaker as much as it's about the actor. Now, the actor is always going to drive it. You know what I mean? So, and there are certain exceptions, of course, where you go, of course, you know, they would do anything. If it was an action movie under $15 million and Jason Statham was in it and it was out of focus.
It can't be because Jason Statham
exactly
is probably
right.
$15 million.
Exactly.
But wait a second. You also said something that was really interesting and I don't want to just gloss over because it's really smart. If you are going from the premise that it's basically a star-driven business, mm-hmm. foreign sales specifically, you're reverse engineering it because you know that the scripts you're developing is actor bait. They want to play cops. They want to play bad guys. They want to play flawed characters. You know, they don't want to play just the run-of-the-mill stuff. So you're weirdly reverse engineering to get those big sales.
Yes.
You're creating scripts that you know will attract the type of talent that will get the foreign sales guys excited.
Yeah, and we're going to – we have things that are a little bit – I'll call them execution dependent, which mm-hmm. is always terrifying because mm-hmm. And those are the roles that I'm finding actors lean in on mm-hmm. and directors. You know, in Sicario, it was really sold on the back of Denis and to a lesser extent Benicio. You know, we're doing a film called Greenland in November. It's Neil Blomkamp and Chris Evans. STX International raised a lot of money. They did an incredible job. And it was 1 + 1 = 4. It mm-hmm. was like, well, 1 + 1 + 1 = 6. It was, mm-hmm. they loved the script. They loved Neil Blomkamp. They loved Chris Evans. And they loved Neil Blomkamp directing Chris Evans in this script. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit more considered now. You know, it's not kind of slapdash.
And was that something that you got as a spec, an idea, a book?
Yeah,
did Neil bring it to you? And then you got Neil next? And then
we got Chris first.
Okay.
I mean, that's the question I mean, asked you, too. It's like, for me, the eternal question about all these films is, do you go to a director first or an actor?
Mm-hmm.
And I've made a mistake of – I've done both, and some have worked and some haven't. You know, the weird thing is, in my experience, when I've gone to an actor first, it's worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that one, Chris Evans read. I didn't go to him. He read it, God bless him, on his own, and called and said, I'm interested. And Neil came on afterwards. And so, you know, the puzzle doesn't really make, but I truly don't look at it, and this is where I got in trouble early in my career. I truly look at it as, what will make the best movie?
Mm-hmm.
And then I let the market quantify that. And the market's smart. So I will make choices. I mean, you're not an idiot. Like, I'm not going to put on a bunch of unknowns for a movie that's $50 million. But in the context of just having experience and knowing what a movie will cost,
mm-hmm.
I try to make decisions early on that will make it for the best movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then however the market reacts to that, it reacts to that. But I've been doing it long enough now where I'm not surprised that often. You know, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm barely going, what? I was that off?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I'm that off at this point in my career, then I haven't been paying attention. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And you're taking bets that you know are off center.
Yes.
And those are the scripts that the actors are going to be attracted to. Because what Chris Evans is probably getting 100 straight up action movies, or you know, romantic comedies, or things that are more studio driven down the middle, and here you come with an off center thing like Sicario or The Town or Current War.
Well, that's the other thing too, is that you know, these films have shown that I'm willing to take some chances,
mm-hmm.
and so Town are like, cool, I'm gonna take a shot with you because. Mm-hmm. You know, you had Benicio del Toro kill the kids at the end of Sicario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Wick is insane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Wind River is like, how the hell did you get that? You know, mm-hmm. there's a lot of these. You know, when you see Hotel Mumbai, you're going to be like, how the hell did you convince people to put money up for this movie? You know,
how did you convince people to put money up for that movie?
On Hotel Mumbai, I have to hand it to Brandon Lehman at WME.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Anthony Morass, this Australian writer and director, he wrote an incredible script.
Did you get it as a script, or did you buy it when you heard about what happened in the terrorist attack?
It was – Anthony asked me to – Adam Levine, our mutual friend, represented him and said, hey, I want to introduce this guy, Anthony Morass. Here's his short film, which is great, called The Palace. And he needs an American on a board, some Adelaide film board, because he lives in Adelaide, Australia. Do you mind doing it? I said, sure. I get on the phone with him. I said, what are you working on? And he's like, I really want to – I just am involved in this documentary about the Mumbai terrorist attacks. It's something that I was really interested in. And I said, well, okay, let's – I'd love to – you know, if you have room, I'd love to figure that out. And then he wrote the script, and it was a script that, you know, I read 15, 16 times over the course before I started shooting it. Mm-hmm. Every time I cried.
Mm-hmm.
Every time. And I was moved by it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this script. It was really good. It was an interesting director. And we went to the only real big international Indian star, which is Dev Patel.
Right.
And Brand Liebman, God bless him, read it, said, this is awesome. Told Dev, you got to read it. Dev read it right away, sat down with Anthony. Brandon also said to Armie Hammer, he's like, hey, there's another role for a character like Armie. And Brandon goes, I'm going to get Armie to read it and like it as well. And boom, we had a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, as much as I want to sound like a genius as a producer, if it wasn't for Brandon Liebman, you know, it could be one of the 65, 70 projects in development. And, you know, he just, God bless these agents who read.
Yeah.
And who give their clients scripts without, that's the other thing too. I mean, the problem with being an independent producer is you rarely, if ever, are you going pair play to people.
Right.
You're always trying to get people to read stuff without an offer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they have it exclusively, but you're saying, like, listen, I'm not a studio. I can't offer you $5 million. I just can't escrow it. And a lot of, you know, there are some actors and some agents will be like, no, but many more do. And, you know, the difference between, I think, Thunder Road Now, when we first started as an independent company, now agents will have actors read our scripts
mm-hmm.
because they know that the stuff's, you know, at least we're trying to do something different.
Yeah.
And something ambitious. And so that's how that movie came together. I mean, and then...
Well, by the way, if you don't get Dev Patel, you're in a world of hurt.
In a world of hurt.
Yeah.
And it's embarrassing. Listen, you'll see in the film, it's, and I'm not exaggerating, I think there are between associate co-producer, executive producer, and producer credits, I think there's 97 credits.
Wow.
Now, a lot of them are in the end credits, thank
sure.
God. But, it, you know,
but that's
it takes
a lot of these movies does take a village to be able to put,
oh my God.
Put all the pieces
we
together.
Had 2 minutes of moving logos before the movie started.
Wow.
2 minutes.
Wow.
it was ridiculous.
Wow. And then you got stuck in the whole Weinstein thing on that one.
Yeah, we had 3 movies there. You know, right. We had Wind River, Current War, which is still stuck there. And Mumbai. That was unpleasant.
And it is unpleasant, too, that that company doesn't exist anymore because there's 3 good movies that somebody bet on you with. And so it's a shame. It's a shame because, you know, those it's important that those movies get made, and hopefully there'll be a couple of companies that'll come in and fill that gap because
I hope.
Obviously they work.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that's, again, I say the same thing on this podcast, too, is don't read trades. Don't listen.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, if you want to know the health of the business, just listen to the, you know, the stock analyst calls from the CEOs of the big 5. And so you've got your financing and you reverse engineer your scripts to get your actors. And then you go and you just cobble together all your financing. Now that you've made so many movies in this way, what is the future of independent film and where is your company headed?
There's no question that the next step is, I mean, when you look at when someone says, I'm going to finance a movie, I always thought before I was an independent financier, if the movie costs $20 million, someone writes a check for $20 million.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, just to use $20 million as an example, you get, you know, $12 million out of foreign sales or foreign sales projections. You get $3 million back from tax credit, and that leaves a $5 million gap. Whoever finances that $5 million gap, that's financing the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can go to a studio, of course, and they can put $5 million out, and that's fine. And so there's no question that it's been a long process that, you know, Thunder Road will look completely different in a year from now than it does now. We will, you know, there was a long time where I wanted to show the town and show the banks and show the financiers and investors that I was truly in the independent film business because I wanted to. And I wanted to show them a good, I don't know what the word is, like that I wasn't just lucky with 2 movies, that there was a flow of projects. And I wanted, and then once that was the case, it was kind of a proof of concept the first 3-4 years. Then it was easier for me to get in rooms with investors and say, okay, I want to grow. And here's what we've done. It's not just one great year. We've had, you know, just in terms of production, we've had so much stuff over the last 3 years and coming up that now we're going to start bringing investors in the company. And what it really means is we'll have more development money and we'll be able to finance our own films.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we'll be able to put that money in, that gap money in there. And
because most of the people who do put that gap money in don't want risk, which
no.
is insane because that's all the movie business is. So what ends up happening is why the movies begin to feel generic and begin to feel watered down is in the effort to mitigate risk, you end up doing the same shit over and over again, putting the same actors in it that may or may not be right for the role,
yeah.
pulling budgets down, and just starts to get into this generic feel that, you know, certain producers do where they just, you know, have a concept and, you know, pay Bruce Willis for a day and throw it up there.
Completely.
So that $5 million, to use your example, is really financing the movie. And I find that the more companies that I talk to that try to, as soon as they say we want to mitigate risk, I'm f***ing out. Because there's no way to mitigate risk without, in my opinion, damaging the movie.
And you're in the wrong business.
Yeah.
I mean,
and so that's what's so great about you is you now going and getting this investment. You're not mitigating the risk because, like you said, you're betting on yourself.
This is a – I deal with it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
People want to know exactly how much money they're going to make on films.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, then you should not be in films. I mean, unless you're a bridge lender or something, if you're going to finance films, you're taking a chance. There is a emotional / ballsy / romantic element of financing films.
Right.
You are dreaming of blue sky.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's hard to find. You know, I've kissed a lot of frogs before I found a prince. You know, I've had a lot of very tough experiences with potential financiers or financiers, a couple of them you and I had mm-hmm. shared unpleasant experiences mm-hmm. with, which I won't name nameless. but, you know, they want to know exactly that it's going to be a win for them. And that's not life. That's not business. I mean,
well, yeah. And also, different than your profit participation statement, which is a whole different morass
yeah.
of bullshit, the P&L statements are bullshit.
Yeah.
So what happens is, and look, I come from a finance background. I've run two movie studios. I've seen 1,000 P&Ls. And I can tell you, you know, you can say, all right, the movie's going to – I'm just going to use a horror movie example. The movie's going to cost six. And if you look at the average of movies that cost $6 million in the horror genre, you should spend 10 on marketing because you should target that. That's what Blum does. That's what good Lionsgate does. That's really well. And then those movies traditionally open to about $11 million. They usually do around 28, 29. Usually it's 60 average. These are averages, for historical averages, let's say, of the last 40 movies. If you're a smart producer, you should be doing this, right?
Yep.
So I go back if I have this movie and I go – cost six, average is not, $10 million. They usually open to 11 point something. They could do 28 and foreign is 60%, which gets you to a $48.9 million worldwide gross on average. So based on that, you probably make, you know, and through the life of the movie, you probably make about $10 million bucks off your initial $5 million investment and then cobbling together all this other shit. So then that's logic. What people do on a P&L then who want to mitigate risk is they go, well, okay, the movie costs six. We got to throw $20 million of marketing at it because we got to get the opening. And we think the movie's going to open to eight. It's probably going to do 25 and foreign is like $5 million.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, that's bullshit. It's total made up numbers. So that movie ekes out like it's going to gross. They think it's going to gross $30 million because everybody has put their 10% pad in there.
Oh my God, I know.
And so then throw on that the distribution fees and the cost of money and all this shit. That, you know, and the cost of money is bullshit too, because you go to a bank, the bank says, look, we'll lend you this money, let's say, you know, prime plus two, and you're going, well, I'm going to put prime plus three because I want my VIG. That's why movies don't get made, because it's all fucking arbitrary. So, you know, when you go in, you go, well, no, but historically, it's $10 million in marketing. The marketing exec's like, well, fuck that. Then I got to be really good.
Yeah.
I got to actually make really good material. And I got to, because if I can't spend, how am I going to get the awareness up? Well, you're going to get the awareness by you have clutter busting material, which that's on you. Make a good fucking trailer. And then the international guy is like, I can't be held to 60%, even though that's a historical average of the last 40 movies. I'm going to say it's $5 million because that's the worst I've ever done. I know I'm going to do five. And when I do, you know, 50%, I'm going to get my bonus.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And so for you to be on the inside and betting on yourself is going to mitigate all of that. Such a great idea.
The challenge is, and I've hit this along the way, which is, okay, pretend I finance the film ourselves, okay? And then we go to a studio. I'll just use Paramount as an example. Just, it could be Warner, whatever. Just I'll use Paramount as an example. And they have no money invested in the movie. They're only doing P&A.
Yep.
Or even if I give them the P&A. What I've learned, because I was at a studio that picked up a lot of these movies when I was an executive at Warner's, there's no real advocate internally there.
No.
You know, and so people are going to – they're going to spend just enough money to get a 6% return, and that's really good compared to the other stuff, and they don't do a lot of executive time. So that is the – that's what I'm trying to figure out, which is how do you incentivize a distributor to have – they'll never have as much skin in the game as you will.
Right.
But how do you do it where they have a lot more skin in the game? Now, I will say this. Sony didn't have a lot of skin in the game on Soldado. They did an incredible job. They did a great, great job. It's because they loved the movie and they're professionals and they got behind it. But I also understand I've been in situations where it didn't go that way. Not recently, but earlier in my career. And that's the tough part, you know, because you're right. People are looking through the lens. I mean, there's so many – the studios are contracting, you know, and they're – I mean, I still haven't figured out – got my wrapped around my hands around Fox and Disney. I just can't imagine it. I mean, Fox is Fox. And I think that you're right. People are not going to – you know, they're not going to go on the line for something unless – I don't know why they're going to go on the line for something.
Nobody will. Even now in studios, if you think about it, right? So generally the head of production gives you a budget and they're going to build in their pad so they can sleep at night.
Yep.
The line producer's like, well, I've got to build in my pad so I can sleep at night. So there's – and then the post-production head of post-production is like, well, I got to build in my pad so I can sleep at night because I don't know this asshole. He could go over. So I build in a 10% VIG. I'm not – it doesn't say that in the line item. I wish it did.
Yeah.
I wish everybody was just honest.
Yeah.
And the head of production goes, look, I don't trust you, Basil.
Yeah.
I'm putting a 10% thing in. You need to sign that. That's a 10% cushion because you might suck.
Yeah.
And it just goes on and on and on and on and on and on. Everybody all the way down the line. The marketing spend, the distribution model, you know, every – all the way down the line, there's all this bloat in the thing. I haven't done a movie in the last 12 years where I haven't come on in under budget because I'm there every day and I do my job and I know what things are supposed to cost and I'm sure you do the same thing. And then there's that 10% pad. You go, oh, there it is. So now I've reduced my fee and I've killed myself And I'm not seeing that 10% pad. That was just so you could sleep. So, but the problem is, because that 10% pad's in there, your green light could be totally hosed because you know the 10 and 10 and 10, you can't hit the number. It's just impossible to hit the number.
Impossible. And everything you just said is why I wanted to be independent.
Mm-hmm.
Because I will control those numbers. And sometimes it'll blow up in my face. And when it does blow up in my face, I pay for it. It comes out of my fee. If it doesn't blow up in my face and the movie does well, then I see upside financially.
Well, you're not only going to see upside, you're going to see the cost of money upside because you're not going to charge that to yourself.
Yep.
You know that you're going to take the bank loan and you're going to pay the bank back whatever.
You see every dime coming in and out.
You're not going to have a distribution fee. Maybe. You might.
No, you will. Yeah, usually.
You might have made that deal, but you're not going to have miscellaneous distribution fees because you're going to have a percentage that's going.
You don't have that massive studio overhead.
You're not going to have overhead.
Yeah.
Exactly. So all that money is in your pocket for taking the quote-unquote risk.
Yeah.
And I really think at the end of the day, If studios could just be banks and operate like banks, everything would be a lot more clear, right? So when you go to get a loan to buy your house, everything's up front.
Yeah.
Here's the fee thing. You know, obviously you hope your property appreciates, but here's the loan. Good luck.
Well, it's also where I found it incredibly effective is I'm able to go to talent, to directors in terms of budget and actors and go, here's what I have. Here's the collateral that I was able to raise. And you could see it. I will say, this is, you have all the information I have. This is why the number needs to be this way.
Right.
It's not some arbitrary thing, or I'm not trying to pad. There is you see it. I'll show you the bank statements.
Yep.
And once they see that clarity, they get on board.
Yeah.
Because I think what they are all afraid of, and I understand this, is like, okay, I'm taking it in the tush, so you guys are making more money than you want to make because your profit margin is bigger. When they all know that we're all in it together,
yeah,
it changes everything. And that's why we're able to make, John Wick was wall-to-wall action in New York City for $28 million.
Mm-hmm.
We could have never done that.
No way.
And so
the studio would never even be able to remotely understand how to do it.
No, they would have said, we don't believe it.
Yeah.
We don't believe the numbers.
It's 35.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Yeah.
And by the way, water seeks its own level. So if they come in and say it's 35, if they would have greenlit it at 35, they wouldn't have. But if they would have, you're going to spend 35. That's the problem. And because you and I do the job every day, you might put Marty in that boat for sure, Neil. And there's, there's DeLuca. There's a ton of others. I've never had a movie go over budget. So every time I'm looking at them going, between you, the line producer, and the post-production supervisor, putting your damn pad in, I not only can't sleep at night, you're causing the movie to be worse.
Yeah.
Because we're rushing. How many times have you done this? Well, you don't really work on studio movies anymore, but there's so many times where we get to the 11th hour and I'm like, come on. And we're beating the shit out of everybody in a good way. Like, come on, guys, we can do this. And the line producer's like, we're fine.
Yeah.
Well, you. You should have told me that 6 hours ago.
Yeah.
You're this little smug thing that line producers do, which is like, we're fine. We have pad in there. Don't worry about it. If everybody doesn't know why what you're saying is so true, is when you show everybody the line items and go, guys, this is it. Like, we cannot go over.
Yeah.
People do it.
I know.
There's this illusion that directors are like, screw you, I'm going to go over. Like,
no.
This,
I think
and it doesn't
some
happen.
Do, by the way.
But well, but not if you are honest up front. I'm sure some people still do. But if you're honest up front, you go, this is all we have, no joke. And it's going to roll over into the next day.
Yeah.
And I'm going to start taking stuff away at the end, because not out of spite, but because I have to finish the movie. I have found that people will kill themselves for you.
I completely agree. And I think the other thing, too, is there hasn't been one independent movie that I've made where I haven't put money into it,
right.
My own fee. Not because
– oh, me too.
I mean, and but happily, we're 100. I will go. I'll pay for it. I mean,
and another thing, even that's the other thing that business affairs people don't understand is when you're putting your fee in or reducing your fee.
Yeah.
They think it's like, well, you shouldn't even your quotes are meaningless anyway, and you're lucky to have the f***ing job.
Exactly right.
When you're reducing your fee,
by the way, just to stop right there, that is exactly right.
100%.
Your quotes are meaningless, and we'll find somebody else to do this job. You're fungible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, a project you got into a bidding war on
and
couldn't have been more excited about 3 years ago, and now you're grinding me to reduce my fee. We're investing in the movie. That's what people don't understand.
Yeah.
By doing that, you're investing in the movie.
Yeah.
You're investing.
You're helping to finance the
yes,
film.
Yes, you are.
I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
That's what I don't.
Yeah.
I agree.
And they always put your box office bonuses just far enough out where they're happy.
Yeah.
Well, we made a little money. Let's give them it back.
Yeah.
That's not the way investment works. When you it's never going to happen. But I believe, the actor reduces, the director reduces, the producer reduces. We should be like the bank. We should be the first guys out.
Yeah.
Right? When that money starts coming in, pay us the f*** back, and then you get yours. That's not the way it works. Studios.
Well, and also, we're rendering services.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that's incredible to me. Like, we're not walking. Listen, it's a joke, but my dream is to be paid off a movie. Imagine that. Here's your entire fee. You don't have to work. I'm like, where do I sign up? That sounds like an amazing gig.
It's never going to happen for you or I, because, like, get your ass down there and do the fucking work.
Never.
And I'm happy to do it. But that is the one thing that I think ultimately, and I was sharing this yesterday with a head of production at a studio, and I was talking about P&Ls, and that person had not seen a P&L in the last 4 years. And the reason why is they're making big tentpole movies that will always cover the gap.
Yeah.
Right? So you're saying, I don't care how much you make Avengers 4. It's going to make $2 billion.
No, it's unbelievable.
There's no – you can throw everything at it. Throw your cost of money. Throw your marketing. Whatever. Spend as much money as you want. You're going to make more.
I have a great – one of my someone – not a close friend, but kind of a friend – represents somebody in the Avengers. And they had box office bonuses that broke at $1.5 billion.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The studios are trying to claw it back. Yeah. Right. So what do you think makes a good producer?
I think taste and a point of view. And it doesn't mean – when I say taste, I'm not saying you have to make Merchant Ivory movies. But whatever your genre that you're in, you have taste within that genre.
Mm-hmm.
I think – And I would say taste / point of view. In other words, you know the story you want to tell.
How do you develop that?
Confidence in your own self, stubbornness, and taking and being a storyteller. I think the best producers are the ones that consider themselves storytellers.
And do you still read as voraciously as you used to?
Well, yes and no. I would say yes. It's a different form now. I'm constantly reading, and I'll read a book every 2 weeks, and I mean, but back in the day, it would be like I had so much more time in my hands.
Are you reading a book that you're just buying for fun, or you're reading a book that's being submitted to you?
For fun.
Okay. And do those books that you're reading for fun inform your storytelling? Are you seeing
everything.
Points of view?
Everything
you read.
Everything I read.
I agree.
Has something that either as a businessman or as a producer or as a storyteller or just a guy, as a dad. And some of it is – and I'm not trying to educate myself. Mm-hmm. It's just stuff that I'm – you know, like, for instance, the book I'm reading now, and it's I'm reading about how the Warriors became this incredible franchise. Mm-hmm. When they were the worst, by far the worst NBA franchise for a long time. I'm reading it because I want to say, like, how did they do that?
Peter Gruber.
Yeah, it was and Bob, no, great hires. You know, Bob Myers, great.
Yeah.
You know, and so I find myself kind of, and then I'm going to read the Bob Woodward book, and I also we're going to read a book which I totally subscribe to about. Not working too hard.
Yeah.
I know it sounds it's
what's funny is you're going to read a book to not work so hard.
No, but I mean it's this really cool book about how, and I think especially now as producers, mm-hmm. if you're not careful and you have meetings constantly, you're just reactive. And as a producer, mm-hmm. you need your time to think,
that
to
is
create.
The absolutely the truth.
And so what I think to go what you say make a great producer, I think someone who is able to create, someone who has a point of view, someone who is who doesn't derive his or her ego from things that most other people do. Like, you're going to get rejected all the time. You're going to be going into a meeting and you're going to be kept waiting for 45 minutes. If you go, oh, I can't believe this. Then
you know who I am?
Yeah, you shouldn't be a producer.
Yep.
And, you know, there was a great line that I remember from The Untouchables, which is you never bring a knife to a gunfight. If you're a producer, especially an independent producer, every circumstance, every interaction you have is going to be a gunfight.
Yeah.
No, go in there prepared, mm-hmm. go in there ready to fight, and go in there knowing that, you know, it's when the dust clears, we're all winners.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the other thing, too. And the big part of being a good producer is understanding that it doesn't matter whose idea it is.
Yeah,
you know,
for
so
sure.
Producing is a strange thing because you have to be so dogged and so crazy and so single minded. But at the same time, you have to be able to, you know, let the, you know, open up the curtains to let other people's point of view come in and not be that, you know, that dominant force on set because people are going to be like, get the fuck out of here.
Right.
And so it's, and also I think now more than ever, and it frustrates me because there is a different way of looking at producing films and how to produce films. And it frustrates me that people don't realize that.
Yeah.
Like people go, okay, if I'm not at a studio, I'm doomed. Or and I'm like, no, there's a third level now, you know, and it's not just television.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to look at the world is changing and producing movies are changing. You have to adapt with the times or else you're doomed.
Yeah. Worst day on set.
I'm not a big set guy in that. I think every day is terrible. I mean, I
anything you can remember specifically, you're like, F- this.
Yeah, that's a good question. Worst day on set. I won't give a specific example, but I have you have conversations with certain crew members or actors or directors that are completely spiteful of financial circumstances or just the how they talk to people are so mm-hmm. mean and nasty. Where all I want to do is go like either punch them mm-hmm. or go F you and walk off the set, yep. and you have to sit there and deal with it.
Yeah,
and you know I'm trying to. The irony is that I've shot films in weird places, in South Africa, in Jordan, in Morocco. And, yeah, there's always crazy experiences. You know, there's always people not showing up or, you know, you hear – on a private war, we thought it was a thunderstorm coming and realized it was just a bombing of Syrian bombs. The Syrian Air Force bombing Syria because we were close to the Syrian border. You know, we've had all sorts of crazy stuff like that. We have had, you know, homeless people attack sets in New York City, all sorts of nuts. But that stuff you kind of roll with. Mm-hmm. Where I kind of go to myself, why am I doing this, is when I'm, you know, 12 hours away from my family. I'm on, you know, day 9, and you've eaten like shit. You don't have good sleeps. You know, you still have an LA business to do. And then you just see people treat other people terribly mm-hmm. or yourself. Mm-hmm. And you just want to say, you want to grab them and go, this is not that hard. If you don't want this job, leave.
Right.
And because for me, I'm no dummy. I know that I'm incredibly lucky. I'm incredibly lucky in that, you know, other than the fact of being a professional athlete, it was my dream mm-hmm. and I got it. I know this job is absurdly cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what we're all doing is we're playing with house money. We're being able to make movies. And I think that there's always a level of – when there's a level of entitlement or of abuse is where I start going, why am I in this?
Right. And best day on set.
The day I know I'm leaving to go home.
Ah!
No, I think
– your memory of like just being in the town or Sicario or Wick that you were just like, this is f***ing cool.
Oh, no. I got to tell you, the great thing about I mean, listen, there were some sets. Well, being in Fenway Park for the shootout in the town was unbelievably cool. You know, closing down Lincoln Center to have a fight sequence in Grand Central Terminal in Wick 2 and Wick 3 was like, this is really cool. You know,
it was a pretty cool shot of Wick riding a horse shooting a guy in the head.
That's insane. Yeah, I mean, it's the same area as the French Connection. And so you're going,
right.
I'm constantly going, hold on, this Keanu Reeves on a horse in the middle of Queens. Like, what the hell is this? So there's always about that. It's funny. I think that my best days on set are the days where you step out of yourself for a minute mm-hmm. and go, look at this.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
Your 17-year-old self in Jersey would be like, holy shit.
Anybody. You know what I mean? Where you go, this is nuts. You know, some of these sets on Clash of the Titans are just – it's insane. Or that one day where most of the – you know, when you have all these great actors and they're all working that day and you're like, this is cool. Like, this is my job.
Yep.
You know, in terms of just great things that I don't even remember. God, it's so
those
funny.
Are pretty cool ones.
Yeah, I mean, but
so what advice do you give to that 17-year-old kid in Jersey right now that's a voracious reader and doesn't really know how to do it? What advice do you give him to become you?
Watch a lot of movies. I mean, I think one of the things that this generation doesn't have that you and I had was just the director's commentary. I know mm-hmm. that sounds funny. Mm-hmm. I learned so much about filmmaking by buying all these DVDs, and not even of the classic movies.
Right.
Any movie.
Gary Marshall's director's commentary on Pretty Woman is a masterclass of directing.
Yeah, there are certain directors where Michael Mann, Ridley Scott, Francis Ford Coppola for that trilogy, and also even like, you know, Battle of Algiers, the Gino Portocorvo is passed away, but it was like Steven Soderbergh and Oliver Stone. That's how you learn. So if there was someone who's 17, I would say find those. Hear about how filmmakers are talking about their craft and how they do it, so you understand what that is. Move out to LA without any plan. Just move out, figure it out. And then for me, get into an agency. Because
mm-hmm.
I started at UTA and I learned, and I never wanted to be an agent, but I had access to every script in Hollywood, short films. I heard, you know, on telephone calls with my bosses, just how people interact with each other. You know, how writers and directors were frustrated, just the business. And I just soaked it up. That was my film school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the agency business knowing that I would never be an agent. And so you're listening to different conversations. And that was my master class.
Right.
And so it would, for me, just be like, watch movies, continue to watch a lot of movies, move out to LA, don't do this whole thing. Like, I need to know where I'm going to live and where mm-hmm. my job, just move out to LA.
Yep.
And then for me, you know, I was a PA for a bit, but it was hell. Like, I thought a PA meant like you had a stand behind a director and look at the monitor. Mm-hmm. No, you're four blocks away blocking off set. Mm-hmm. So go somewhere where you're in the belly of the beast. Not have an ego about things. You know, when I was in the mailroom, I like, you know, delivered a Christmas tree to Mike Myers' house. It was like not have an ego and be patient and just, you know, the only thing you could really do, and I know you well enough, you did this too when we were younger, the only thing we control is outwork other people.
Yep.
If you outwork other people, then you're halfway there.
Right.
And I think that that work ethic is everything.
Yep.
You know, people ask me, what are the two things of the business that surprised you the most? One, how hard people worked. Like when I was growing up in Jersey, I thought, you know, people, it was LA, you know, people, it's slow. People work so hard.
Yep.
And I think that's what you have to go in and you have to go, I am going to just not think about anything else but work.
Right.
And then you have a shot.
Yeah. Well, great advice, man. Thank you. I got to be
respectful
of your time. I appreciate you doing this.
No, of course.
And I'll see you in the next couple of days.
I know. No,
at a football game or something.
I know. I'm sure there'll be a couple mutual. I know there's a couple of our mutual friends that will be listening to this just to see the awkwardness if there is one.
That's not awkward.
Of course not.
We are the modern sitcom. We are.
No one ever believes it. I tell people all the time.
It can be done.
It's actually kind of amusing.
Yeah. All right, brother.
Thanks, Doc.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Katie McEwen, Kirsten Woodward, and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts. The King of Celebrity Gossip is now on Podcast One.
Kim Kardashian, I think she's nice, but obnoxious and annoying.
Check out the Perez Hilton Podcast with Chris Booker each week to get your fill on the latest news in show business and beyond. And nothing is off the table.
I think he should take her last name when they get married. He's already her bitch. He should just be her bitch officially.
Check out the Perez Hilton Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you listen to podcasts.